is irresistible.
Yes, indeed. Oh, taking me back to the days of what we could call it new romantic, but not at all, really. It is the subject of a new book called Listening to the Music the Machines Make, Inventing Electronic Pop from 1978 to 1983. It is written by Richard Evans. Delighted to say that Richard is joining me live on the line from somewhere in deepest, darkest Dorset, I believe. Richard, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you too.
Good to have you with us. Just playing that takes me back to sort of, because previous to bands like Yazoo and Vince Clarke and Depeche Mode and everything that came in, Kraftwerk, of course, which had come over from Germany before that. But we were just surfing off, if you like, the punk wave, which was, you needed a drummer and you needed a bass player. But with the advent of you know, the Moogs or Moogs, however you want to call them, and Casio keyboards, etc., you didn't even need a drummer. What was going on, Richard?
Well, this is absolutely true, and it's like, I think you've picked up on something that's really, really important in this story. People think of electronic music as being very sophisticated and very smooth and very polished, and yet at the beginning of my book, when I start writing about the electronic pop that was happening in 1978, it was the opposite of that. It was like synthesizers were put into the hands of people who had pretty much no musical experience, no musical knowledge. They'd sort of come up in the coattails of punk. So they'd sort of seen punk happening. They were probably just a little bit too young to take part in it themselves. And then all of a sudden, they could afford synthesizers. Synthesizers became about the same price as an electric guitar. So all of a sudden, these kids had synthesizers that they couldn't really play. And because they couldn't really play them, they were just sort of like jabbing at the buttons, making all these strange noises, you know, doing their best to sort of, you know, come out with a tune of some sort. And in doing that, they kind of created a whole new sort of music, which was kind of incredible.
Because if you put it in context, if you'd seen where we've been going with synthesizers and keyboard players, we're in the, you know, this is the mid 70s, so the end of 70s. You know, you've got keyboard players who are basically playing eight stacked high with their, you know, with their toenails. You know, I'm thinking Emerson, Lake and Palmer stand up at the back. You're thinking Rick Wakeman. We're thinking those huge, you know, those big sort of heavy or those big rock monsters with massive keyboards, which were great, but, you know, they were great, keyboard players, but it wasn't something, it almost intimidated you from getting hold of a piano. Yet with this new technology, it didn't kind of matter if you made a noise and you didn't need to learn a fretboard. You just kept playing something until something kind of sounded right.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you didn't need a tune necessarily. Like you say, it is all down to making a noise. And I think a lot of the people who were making music at that time were kind of looking, you know, with one eye on people like Emerson, Lake and Palmer and the progressive bands who are sort of at one end of the spectrum. But they're also bringing in stuff from punk. Not so much the musical stuff, because that was kind of a little bit old-fashioned at that time. But, you know, the sort of the DIY attitude and the sort of, you know, the go out and do it yourself, that's fantastic. But they were also bringing in disco and rock music and, you know, everything they could find and sort of putting it into this blender. And it just came out as this sort of whole new lexicon of musical sound.
When I think about these sort of bands, I mean, Kraftwerk notwithstanding, who are, if you like, the granddaddies, and they were doing this back in the day but they didn't sort of leap around an awful lot. But I seem to remember, because I was, you know, around at that time, is it a particularly sort of British phenomenon, this, as all these sort of nascent, because I was scratching my head and thinking, because over the pond, it sort of became house music, and they took those electronic riffs and those electronic machines and did something completely different with it.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. It's like at the beginning, it is kind of an English thing. And I think that that's partly because England is quite small. So geographically, it allows you to sort of send a new movement into the mainstream in a fairly quick and effective way. But then, as you very, very rightly say, at the end of my book in 1982 and 1983, the American black street artists were picking up on, it's like African Mambato was playing things like Gary Numan and Depeche Mode and Telex and all these strange things. And I think this electronic music sort of fitted in with the very precise beats required for DJ culture. So these DJs could sort of mix these things together and they could drop them in and out and, you know, do all their sort of clever technical things. And in the doing of that, they created again a whole new revolution in electronic music, which sent it towards, as you said, house music in Chicago, and then to Detroit, where it became techno.
And if you think about the sort of influence and how it sits within the scheme of music at the time, so we know we're getting out from that old sort of prog rock shudder sort of period. Punk's basically crashed and burned and gone up its own thing, unless you've got a keyboard player, stand up the Stranglers, and obviously I'll keep the damned out of that. We've got new wave coming in, which, if you like, is coming from the States, CBG. So we got Blondie, etc., and a certain amount of the Police. Elvis Costello, but this, you know, this particular segment almost keeps itself to itself, and it struck me it's very, very elegantary. It's very female friendly. The first, if you think about Vince Clarke and Yazoo, I played obviously Yazoo when we first come in. I mean that launched Alpha Maye on an unsuspecting nation, Alpha at the time, and not only was she a female singer, but she wasn't a female singer in a sort of ZZ Top rock, all sort of, shall we say, assets to the front. I mean, she came across as a normal person. She wasn't a particular shape or size.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because there aren't a great deal of women in the story that I write about. So I write about electronic music in Britain from 1978 to 1983, and one of those people is, of course, Alison Moyet, who was a very ballsy, very honest, very, very bluesy singer. You know, it's like she took no prisoners. It's like, and she probably didn't, she probably couldn't have survived in that world without having that attitude. And the other sort of extraordinary female character in the story is Annie Lennox, who equally, you know, took no prisoners. You know, it's like she's completely fantastic and, you know, controls her own destiny and, you know, suffers fools not so gladly.
How was it like for these original pioneers to sort of set up? Because there's no drummer, so it can literally just be, you know, Vince Clarke and, you know, I mean, although, you know, Alison Moyet, Al's voice is incredible. And I think when she cut her first solo album, people went, oh, didn't know she could sing like that. But that was what made Jesus so great, because you had this almost the sterile thing of the keyboards with her expressive voice. So how did they set up? Where were the first gigs, and how they were they received by an audience?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about Depeche Mode, because Depeche Mode were one of the very early bands who were purely electronic. There were bands already operating in this area. People like Ultravox, the early Ultravox, were already operating, but they were pretty much a rock band with electronics on top. But one of the very first purely electronic bands to sort of, you know, to start to move through to the mainstream was Depeche Mode, which was great. But they used to go on the train to their gigs. You know, they're from Basildon and Essex, and they put their synthesizers under their arm, and they get on the train and they go to their gig, and they set themselves up and they put their synthesizers on beer crates, and they play their show, and they pack it all up and put it back under their arm and back on the train and home again. So it's like it became a whole new way of sort of presenting themselves, and, you know, the infrastructure required to put on a show changed as well.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because you mentioned them getting on a train again, but Depeche Mode, I mean, again, 1982, I was 14, so when they first started coming out, they just looked like guys, you know, I would bump into at school, and that was perhaps the appeal between, you know, of them. They weren't doing that whole glam rock god thing. And if you think about some others who came, if you think about like the way that Gary Numan was perceived, I mean, he was, like it or unlike it, he was unfairly perceived as the natural lineage of Bowie and Eno, even though that wasn't what he was trying to do. And there are famous tales of, you know, Bowie throwing him out of a watching him record, because they, I mean, you can go back and say, right, you know, Heroes, 70, you know, all, the whole Berlin trilogy, that's a lot of electronic music. Eno's dabbling around as well, but what they've got, massive systems and studio time, and what Depeche Mode have got and Annie Lennox have got is literally little keyboards and an idea in let's do the show here mentality.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's quite incredible. And like you say, it's like growing up at that time was fascinating, I think, in many ways, partly because I think pop music got younger again. And I think partly that's to do with Smash Hits. So Smash Hits started up in 1979. And because Smash Hits was like one of the first colour music magazines in this country that was coming out as frequently as it was coming out every 2 weeks at that time, they were always on the lookout for highly visual artists. So you just mentioned Blondie. Blondie were on the cover pretty much every issue because they looked fantastic. You know, they were absolutely brilliant. But the sort of the new wave of electronic synth artists immediately seized on this. I mean, they were young and they were sort of quick to respond. And they started to sort of, you know, to emphasize their image. They started to sort of, you know, get glossier. They started to get more photogenic, more interesting looking. And that sort of like fed into this whole new machine of media.
And also, if you think of the way that sort of Top of the Pops was going, which was the only, before the Tube came along, it was the only TV thing we saw. Top of the Pops was pre-recorded. You had three people in a band with a, you know, with a keyboard. We couldn't tell if it was miming in a way that, and of course, in a way that they looked with the bright, shiny lights of Top of the Pops and all that neon, it looked really good, didn't it?
Absolutely. It looked really good. And it also felt really exciting because it was kind of something that people weren't used to. It didn't sort of share the same rock tradition that the music that your mum and dad used to listen to. You know, so they might have played you, you know, Bowie records or T-Rex records or glam rock records. But this was something very new and something very different. And I think because there was this whole new sort of teenage revolution where music fans were getting younger, These kids immediately seized on this new thing that was all their own and just sort of ran with it. And the sort of the purchase power of those kids was extraordinary. And, you know, records were selling 100, 200,000 copies, you know, just for a single that maybe got into the top 10.
And not only that, though, but I remember because the Argos catalogue, suddenly in 1981, 82, everybody wanted a drum machine, if nothing else. You know, everybody was like, we're going to create that. And people talk now about, oh, well, YouTube, it means that kids are creating music in their bedrooms and nobody sees them. This is the mother node. This is the let's have a bash. Let's try. And obviously, we're talking about the ones that are successful, but there must have been millions or thousands of people thinking, you know, get the Argos catalogue arrives. We've got this bog standard little Casio with a drum machine. You know, here we, I mean, every sixth form college had a band like ours was called Pink Window, for example, you know, with the bad hairstyle and the attitude and didn't move around much. You're nodding your head, Richard, in agreement with that one.
It is absolutely true. It's like, you know, the electronic instruments became the sort of the new normal. So all the kids who were sort of setting up their first bands, instead of doing that sort of, you know, playing the status quo riffs, they were instead, you know, playing the Depeche Mode, you know, musical moments. So it completely redefined the way a band could be. It completely redefined the way you could make music. And it completely redefined the way you could record music because you could do it all, like you said, in your bedroom. Mm. You know, it's like the machines were relatively small. You didn't really have to have a lot of space for them. You didn't have to make a lot of noise with them so that your mum didn't mind so much. You know, it wasn't like you had a drum kit, you know, in the front room. It's like you could just put your headphones on, plug them into whatever it is you're using and just get on with it.
Absolutely. I'm just also thinking about, we talked about Annie Lennox. You know, crossing the boundaries with obviously Sweet Dreams. And I remember my parents looking at that video and going, what on earth is this? Because, you know, the cross-dressing. We talked about Alf not conforming to stereotypical what a woman should look like. Mark Allman, Soft Cell. Now there was a band. I mean, forget Boy George in his frippery doing his pantomime Dame Act. But if you think about how subversive Mark Allman, and again, the voice that goes through, and the fact that they, obviously Mark was Mark, but, you know, that wasn't the thing that made Soft Cell a great band. It was great tracks and also great production and a sly humour as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think Soft Cell had a credibility that wasn't always there with all the electronic acts. And there was something quite dangerous and a bit sleazy about Soft Cell. You know, it's like they were dark and they dressed darkly, you know, in black. You know, Mark Allman with his thousands of bangles up his arm, you know, and his black eyeliner. And then sort of Dave Ball in the background, you know, big and menacing and, you know, unsmiling. But they were churning out fantastic pop music at the same time. And it's like they both came in from the sort of the Northern Soul scene. And when we're very influenced by those kind of records, which is why they sort of ended up, you know, releasing soul classics like Tainted Love and, you know, like Where Did Your Love Go and like What? So they had these sort of songs that they just recreated for the new generation.
But what it did was it brought those songs, which perhaps you wouldn't have heard to an 80s generation like myself. So we had Tainted Love, we had songs like that. I mean, you know, Paul Young. I know he's not an electronic artist, but bringing Love of the Common People those soul songs were revisited in the early 80s. Just thinking about you know, the unsmiling bit, but there was as well, it wasn't just all, I'm going to pretend to be a 50s nightclub singer. There was a serious edge. And if you're looking for some people who actually trying to put a message, Cabaret Voltaire and the Human League, and people might think the Human League is that sort of 80s, mid 80s thing, but at the beginning they were raw and they had a point to prove. And obviously they then went on, members left and formed Heaven 17, who were much more political.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that actually there's not many bands who were present at the beginning of my book who were still operating at the end of my book. And there are a couple, Ultravox are one, but they changed into a different band by midway through. Human League, as you say, were another, and they changed quite dramatically over that period. The first two Human League albums were very experimental, very strange, very pretentious, I suppose, and deliberately so. And Virgin Records decided that it was time for them to have a hit, and they felt that they were already writing hits. And then a split was arranged by Human League's manager, and it basically left Phil Oakey and Adrian Wright, which is the singer and the guy who does the slides on stage, on one side of the split, and Ian Craig Marsh and Martin Ware on the other side of the split, who were the two guys who actually made the music and did the synthesizers. So all the money was on the two guys who did the synthesizers, and the Human League, who are Phil and Adrian at that point, crashing and burning. Yet, in fact, they brought in some new pop people, recruited two girls as backing singers, went on tour, and reinvented themselves as possibly the most successful electronic pop act ever.
Never forget the power of a decent video as well. This is just at the start of the MTV. I remember seeing Don't You Want Me Baby, etc. And people were just obviously transfixed by the video. We also talked about Vince Clarke, but he has, you know, he was, and correct me if I'm wrong, originally in Depeche. Was Vince in Depeche originally, or did he, am I getting my...
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Depeche Mode was founded by Vince. It was Vince and Fletch to start with, and they recruited Dave and they recruited Martin. And they made the first album together, all four of them. Vince wrote all the songs, I think, apart from one. And that's why that album is such the bubblegum pop that sort of led into Yazoo and then into Erasure.
Yeah.
And that they toured with that, and Vince decided that he didn't really like the limelight. He didn't really like the interviews and the, you know, getting on buses and the travel. He would rather be in his studio. He realized that he could make his music himself. He didn't actually need a band to be doing it with. And that was the reason that he left Depeche Mode and went off to do his own thing, which became Yazoo.
Yeah, Yazoo. And then, of course, Erasure. And again, we've got this, because it was a clubbing culture, there's a gay culture thing in there, Erasure. Obviously, they had no problem with sexuality. Just occurred to me, Bronski Beat, one of the greatest synth bands. Again, absolutely. Small town boy, looking at, you know, my parents looking at the screen and Askins going, what on earth is, what is he watching that guy diving? But again, it just goes to show how open the scene was.
Yes, absolutely. It opened it in every single direction. You know, it was music, it was sexuality, it was fashion, it was media, like say, so it was video, it was, you know, this sort of new colour aesthetic. It's like they pushed boundaries in every sense. And it was kind of extraordinary. And no one, although these bands do get the respect, it's like it felt to me when I started writing the book, like no one had really quite celebrated this scene sufficiently.
So I'm just thinking about, you're talking about bands who are still going, and I'm just thinking about sort of Depeche Mode in the early 2000s, like Dave Gahan, you know, playing Los Angeles and throwing guitar shapes at the, I mean, that, in a rock god gear, you know, obviously he had his own problem, but that was as far away from being sort of a quiet guy on a tube to, you know, a train from Basildon. Who did you speak to when you put this together? Thankfully, there are still quite a few of them left, you know, amongst us.
There are quite a lot of them around, and I'm very fortunate to have access to quite a number of them. But actually, I tried not to speak to them wherever I could, simply because, excuse me, I read all the books that come out, all the new books. I read all the interviews that people give today. And I started to realize that the bands... They don't. I'm not going to say that they lie. I'm just going to say that sometimes they adjust the truth slightly to make themselves look better, or sometimes they just don't actually remember the details. So instead of talking to people and saying, what do you remember about this B-side from 45 years ago? I went back to the original press of the time. So I read all the NMEs, the Melody Makers, the Sounds, the Record Mirrors, the Smash Hits, New Sounds, New Styles, the Face, Blitz, ID, everything I could lay my hands on for this 6-year period. And I collected all the writings, the interviews, the reviews, the live reviews, the news stories. And those were the bits that I assembled the book from. So when I had a question that I couldn't answer from the original materials,
yeah.
I was lucky enough to have people I could ask, but basically I didn't want to bring them in with all their lies.
You have a you have stronger willpower than me, because if I was given a bunch of The Face, I'd forgotten about ID. I'd forgotten what an absolute monster of a magazine that was in the early 80s, of course. I'd just be going off on a really strange tangent. Wouldn't get any work done at all.
Well, doing the research was fantastic fun, exactly because of that, because I was just reliving these years just by turning these pages over and over again. It was quite amazing.
And whilst other forms of music perhaps have lost their immediacy during the passing of time, do you think it is because we talk about the massive influence it has on the clubbing scene later on, and stuff comes in that for house and techno as well, and that whole scene, and you could argue that the whole rave scene comes from that as well, and we're down to EDM with David Guetta waving his memory stick in the air, of which more probably not later, but with that was, if you like, the mother node. And even though the kids quote unquote don't understand it, a lot of the stuff that comes today and a lot of the progressions they're using and the bits they're stealing are from, again, just two people, keyboard, drum machine, and a good microphone.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. It's like it's fascinating that when something is brand new, which it was for this sort of, very short moment for these bands in the late 70s and the early 80s, you're out there and everything you do is pioneering. And then as time goes by, the things that you've done become influences on the next people who come along, and those things start to be sort of integrated into their work. And as that timeline progresses, there's more and more things being thrown in. But yeah, if you sort of strip it down, you can still find the influences that come from the very beginning.
Why did you cut it off at 83? Was about by that point everybody was using a synthesizer was getting bigger. I'm just thinking because obviously 85 is Hands of Love with the Fairlight with Kate Bush, which is a huge synth thing. And again, we get to that point where people are pushing the boundaries back to almost prog rock levels of idea and also production.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I stopped in 1983 because by that point I felt that it was starting to become really difficult to work out who was an electronic artist and who wasn't. Because even the artists who weren't electronic artists were bringing electronic sounds so fully into their music. So they were using samplers, they were using drum machines, they were using, the sort of producer technology that was made popular by people like Martin Rushent and Trevor Horn. These things were all happening. And it felt that the word electronic pop was kind of meaningless at that point. So I stopped in 1983, really, because that was the year that Blue Monday, New Order's Blue Monday, sort of peaked in the charts. It'd been hanging around in the charts for like a year, but that was its moment. And Blue Monday was a fantastic record in the movement towards what came next. So towards African Bambaataa, towards Grandmaster Flash, towards techno, towards house. So that felt like a good place to stop and maybe give it over to some other books.
You have just taken me right back to a discotheque somewhere in North Staffordshire in 1983 with girls with those long skirts that were cut tight as well, and their hair blimey. But yes, I remember the first time hearing Blue Monday and going, good grief, and the sound system and the lights and everything. The book is, if people want to have a look, by the way, if people want to check out more about you, and if you were to say, pick a couple of albums, vinyl, download, however you want to do it, what would you say? Would it, Upstairs at Eric's? What would you say?
Upstairs at Eric's would be a fantastic one. There's Dare, of course, Human League Dare, and there's a spin-off album from Dare called Love and Dancing, which not everybody knows, but it's basically Martin Rushent, the producer, takes the tracks from Dare, And he remixes them into a remix album called Love and Dancing, which was released just after Dare, which is fantastic.
I should
very much has stood the test of time.
And in case you didn't know, Upstairs and Eric's is Yazoo. This book is called Listening to the Music the Machines Make, Inventing Electronic Pop, 1978 to 1983. It is by Richard Evans, who will be speaking today. Richard, people want to find you on all sorts of various mediums. Where can they track you down?
They can track me down at inventingelectronicpop.com, which is the website for the book. And there is also a Instagram and Facebook page, both of them under the at Inventing Electronic Pop.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. You've taken me back with some very fond memories indeed, Richard Evans. And the book will also be available as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore. The book is called Listening to the Music the Machines Make, Inventing Electronic Pop. It's by Richard Evans. Richard, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.